Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Rich Turnbull. I'm one of the MoMA lecturers on the staff here. And I am happy to be here giving the first in the series of late winter and spring brown bag lunch lectures. And today the topic is going to be on essentially Cézanne and geometry, the longer version of the title on the screen for you, of course. And besides being on the staff here at MoMA, I'm also on the education staff at the Metropolitan Museum, where I give lectures and programs, et cetera. My actual full-time job is that I'm the chairperson of art history at FIT. And it's the first week of classes there, and as soon as this lecture is over, I am racing off to FIT to teach my 2 o'clock class.
What is FIT?
FIT is the Fashion Institute of Technology. It's sort of an art and design school here in New York. It's part of SUNY. So I just mentioned that to you because, although normally I hang out a little bit after the lecture to chat with people, I'm afraid today I won't be able to do that, because there will be eager 19-year-olds awaiting me several blocks south of here.
Well, that's better than us.
Believe me, it's not. So the first thing I thought I would tell you about is if you are a regular brown bag lunch lecture attendee, you may know that we actually come up with the schedules for the titles and the programs about 6 months or so in advance. And when I was asked 6 months or so ago, probably still summer at that point, what I wanted to lecture about, you know, in the spring season, I thought that what I would do is to try and extend a little bit of the talk I sometimes give on Cézanne and the birth of modernism, on highlights tours and sometimes gallery talks, etc. One of the things that you will notice if you are a regular MoMA goer, if you've been up to the permanent collection of painting and sculpture, which begins on the fifth floor, no matter what incarnation of the museum you have visited, whether it is this one, which people are still calling the new MoMA, even though it did open over 3 years ago at this point, the previous incarnation, no matter what, you always were greeted when you entered the permanent collection with about a half dozen Cézannes. That's the first thing you looked at if you visited the collection chronologically, etc. And I don't know if you've ever thought about the reason for that, why the curators, you know, and why the authorities here at MoMA have arranged the paintings in the order that, in fact, they did. Why you're looking at what in which order is another way of saying that. But the narrative of modernism, the story of modern art that this museum tells you, basically begins in what's called the post-impressionist period, which, as the name implies, is this group of artists working mostly unrelated, you know, unrelated styles, etc., after the heyday of French Impressionism, after what Andy Warhol would call French Impressionism's 15 minutes of fame, which came between about 1870 and 1885. And for all practical purposes, the narrative that MoMA has constructed for you, the visitor, casual or otherwise, is that the history of modern painting really begins with Paul Cézanne, the French painter working in the late or the later decades of the 19th century until his death in 1906. And I'll show you a self-portrait of Cézanne. This is a self-portrait, in fact, that was painted in 1875 by Cézanne. We are interested today, and what I will mainly be focusing on, are paintings from Cézanne's later decades, particularly from the mid-1880s onward, which is to say about the last 20 years or two decades of his working life. And one of the reasons that Cézanne is so emphasized in the galleries on the fifth floor is that he plays a very crucial role in determining the course of modernism, particularly modern painting. And I should tell you here, partly by way of disclaimer, that this is not a new idea. I'm not, you know, the idea that Cézanne looked at the world and saw geometric structures and that he is really at the forefront of the birth of modern painting, etc., is not some idea I happened to come upon last weekend, you know, shouting out Eureka in the bathtub or something. This is a pretty well-known and pretty consensus view of the story of modernism. But what we're going to investigate today is to try and figure out a little bit more specifically how Cézanne is linked up with geometry. And then by the end of the lecture, hopefully you will understand not only Cézanne's importance with geometry and geometric structure, but where his emphasis on that leads to in 20th century art. In other words, we'll try and come back and justify this idea that Cézanne is really there and present at the start. There is, of course, lots of evidence. I mean, you know, you can construct an argument very easily that without Cézanne, you don't get to most of the things that happen, you know, in avant-garde art in the 20th century. You do not get to Picasso. You do not get to Cubism. You do not get to Matisse and his emphasis on flat planes of color. You could even argue that you probably don't even get to abstraction with somebody like Kandinsky beginning in 1910. And we will kind of touch on all of these things for the most part. I think that it's also true that even artists like Picasso and Matisse looked very closely at Cézanne's work in their formative years, which is to say the first decade or so of the 20th century, and they acknowledged Cézanne's importance, they acknowledged his influence. Matisse is quite famous and well-known for saying, well, Cézanne, he is simply the father of us all, meaning the father of all painters working in the avant-garde at that time in the early 20th century. And if you have been in the galleries, you will note that one of the first paintings you see, because it's directly across from you on a divider wall in that first post-impressionist gallery, is Cézanne's large bather from 1885. And this is a kind of a signpost for MoMA's collection of late 19th century modernist painting. Why Cézanne is so important to this story and what the curators sort of hope you will glean from looking at a half dozen or so of Cézanne's canvases has partly to do with what Cézanne is not doing in his work. And what he is not doing is kind of following the general formulas, the principles, if you like, the rules for painting that were basically established in the Italian Renaissance about four centuries before, and which in some ways, if you know your art history, derive even further back to, for example, painting in the Roman Empire, first century BC, first century of the Common Era, etc. What we're really talking about here is the idea that the real purpose of painting is to somehow create an illusion of the three-dimensionality that is out there in the visible world in front of your eyes and recreate that illusion mainly by means of linear perspective and various other devices using light and shadow, etc., on a flat surface, such as a piece of canvas or a piece of paper, or, of course, if you're working in the Italian Renaissance, big vaulted fresco ceilings, etc. And Cézanne is one of the first significant artists to really deviate from this very well-established set of rules, formulas, guidelines, whatever you want to call them. And one of the things that Cézanne does, and this doesn't happen automatically in his work, and it's not as if he is born painting this way, but he gradually begins, for example, not only to divest his paintings of this emphasis on light and shadow, for the most part, he also begins to flatten out the forms in his painting. One of the words that art historians love to use in terms of Cézanne's work is fragmentation. This idea of looking at, let's say, a landscape or a still life or even his not quite as numerous figure studies and interpreting what's going on there and really breaking it down into a series of fragments. And in turn, those fragments are constructed by means of basically rectangular colored brushstrokes, which we will take a look at in just a minute. You can see, though, that even in this painting from 1885, Cézanne is still practicing some of the techniques of painting that were well in place, you know, by the time he began his career in the 1860s. He is still, for example, outlining the forms of the bather with this dark black line. That is something that Cézanne will shortly renounce and will shortly declare that's something we really must get away from as painters. And that's very much a convention, especially of 19th century French painting, but that, you know, extends back several centuries as well. You can still see places where there are highlights of light and dark which are being used, which does give you at least a kind of partial illusion of three-dimensionality, particularly on the legs, the knees, the calves, the upper thighs of the bather, etc. That's all on its way out as well. That's partly why I think this is one of the first paintings you see when you're up there in the fifth floor galleries. You see this, and then you realize that most of what comes next is going to be moving away even from this, what as was at the time, a fairly radical way of looking at the world and reconstructing it on canvas. For example, if you look at this, I guess we would call this either a landscape or an architectural landscape, if you like. This is a painting that Cézanne made about 12 years after the large bather. This is a painting called The Turning Road at Montgeroux, It's a small town in Provence where Picasso, or rather where Cézanne was from originally, where he spent a lot of time in his lifetime, particularly later in his life. And essentially, if you look at the way this painting is constructed, almost everything here, whether it's the foliage in the foreground, the architectural shapes of the town in what we might call the middle ground, and the sky in the background. First of all, one of the things you realize is that this whole idea of foreground, middle ground, and background, and what happens to colors, and what happens to perspective, has already pretty much been abandoned in this work. And especially if you look at the brushstrokes here in the foreground that taken together make up the foliage on this side of the turning road right there, you can see that they are basically constructed from a series of rectangular brushstrokes set down parallel to one another. In fact, you could almost say that what Cézanne is doing here is constructing a grid of colored brushstrokes. And that is the basic material. That's the raw matter which forms the structure in this particular painting. It's, I think, correct. You very often will hear this talked about in textbooks and, you know, by lecturers here and whatnot. And I know I say this all the time when I'm discussing Cézanne in the galleries, that rather than to say Cézanne painted this particular work, you can say quite accurately he built this painting. You know, you can use this architectural metaphor where the individual brushstrokes of color literally become the building blocks of the structure of the matter of the painting itself. And once I think somebody more or less explains this to you, it's something you can figure out. You don't really need a charming, helpful lecturer in the galleries to explain this to you, although we all think that's always a bonus when that happens, mm-hmm. of course. You understand that Cézanne really is seeing the visible world out in front of his eyes in a very radically different way than almost every artist, not just in the 19th century, but most artists who really, you know, in a sense, come before Cézanne in this grand tradition of 20,000 years of painting that extends all the way back to prehistoric cave paintings. And you see another one of Cézanne's late works here. These are all in MoMA's collection so far, except for the self-portrait. This is called Trees and Rocks, and it dates from 1900. I think the turning road at Montgeroux is on view right now. The Cézanne's get rotated around quite a bit, so you're never sure what you're going to get when you go up to the fifth floor gallery. The same sort of approach here. In fact, the word that is very often used for Cézanne's extremely late works, that is those dating from 1900 until his death in 1906, is kaleidoscopic, that Cézanne takes a sort of kaleidoscopic view of the world around him. You can see the way that comes into play, particularly if you look at the rocks and the foliage here in the foreground, and just that kind of shattering of three-dimensional shapes into a faceted one-dimensional or two-dimensional plane of colors for the most part. Now, I think what's sort of interesting about Cézanne when you try to approach his work in terms of geometry, I mean, this is all very easy to explain, and we're using very general terms here. If, of course, you are in the mind of a detective and you're trying to figure out where is the evidence for all of this, what did Cézanne actually think about geometry? You know, we love to talk about how we interpret painters' works or sculptors' works or whatnot. You can always make a much better case for that if you have some kind of primary sources for which or with which you can back up your general statements. And in Cézanne's case, that's a little bit difficult. It's not that he wrote nothing. He's not an artist like Jackson Pollock, you know, in the 40s and 50s, who essentially wrote nothing about any of his work and didn't really like to speak much about it. There is a body of first-person documentation, which you might call primary sources, for Cézanne, but it's almost entirely in the form of letters that he wrote to friends, acquaintances, fellow painters, etc. And Cézanne did not write theoretical articles, you know, for art journals and things like that, because basically such things didn't really exist in the late 19th century when he was working. And if you comb through this body of letters, and they've all been translated, and they're readily available, these are not, you know, obscure documents by any means, you find that he says almost nothing about art in most of his letters. He is mainly talking about friends, family, he complains a lot. It's sort of like reading somebody's email today for the most part. And it's not until quite late in Cézanne's life, particularly like the last, I would say, 5 or 6 years of his life, that you start finding a few mentions of his attitude toward and theories about art and painting, etc. And even among those, the letters that mention this are basically limited to about three correspondents, three people with whom Cézanne carried on a correspondence. One was a young artist named Émile Bernard, who you may have heard of him if you're kind of mildly conversant with this particular period. And he died in 1941. The other was a young poet who approached Cézanne to make his acquaintance, a man named Joaquim Gasquet, and he would die in 1921. And the third was a young art student who, like Gasquet, approached Cézanne and sort of sought out his friendship. This was a man named Charles Camoin. And the letters that are addressed to these three people are really the only ones in this quite large body of correspondence that contain any of Cézanne's musings, if you like, about art. Now, in terms of Émile Bernard, Bernard actually carried out an interview, a written interview with Cézanne, or oral interview that he then transcribed, but did not publish until 1921. Some 15 years or so after Cézanne's death. And in that published version of the interview, Cézanne did basically speak of the idea of making a vision as a painter. That's what your job is. You have to construct a vision somehow. And what he says is, one must make an optic. One must see nature as no one has seen it before you. And I mean by optic a logical vision that is nothing of the absurd. And if you read the full transcript of this this interview, one of the things Bernard keeps trying to do is pin down Cézanne's use of the word optic, because it clearly suggests to him something to do especially with physics and the principles of physics and optics, etc. And Cézanne really is not having any of it and just kind of evades the question entirely and goes on to other similarly generalized musings about things. But what's clear in a lot of his letters is that Cézanne is really talking about, you know, truth to nature, or truth in nature. That's his own particular vision. He emphasizes that over and over and over again. And in fact, in the letter that is most often quoted by people who are interested in this whole idea of Cézanne and geometry, this is a letter that Cézanne wrote to Émile Bernard. It's dated April 15th, 1904. Cézanne said, "Treat nature by the cylinder, the sphere, the cone, everything in proper perspective, so that each side of an object or plane is directed toward a central point. Lines parallel to the horizon give breadth. Lines perpendicular to this horizon give depth. But nature for us men is more depth than surface, whence the need of introducing into our light vibrations, represented by reds and yellows, a sufficient amount of blue to give the impression of air." That's about the closest you're ever going to get to Cézanne's formula for painting. And even there, it's somewhat generically phrased, but he is mentioning specific colors. He's talking about clearly parallel and perpendicular lines. He's talking about several specific geometric shapes. And there are a lot of art historians who've tried to extrapolate from this particular letter and tried to work out a sort of construction that Cézanne used in his work. One of the interesting things, of course, I want to show you a slide of two earlier works from Cézanne. This is a male nude from 1865 on the left, and that is a bather on the right-hand side, which predates by about 8 years the large bather that we were just looking at before, and that dates from 1877. This is really what Cézanne is getting away from. You know, this is a very clear illustration, especially on the left. You can see that he's still outlining his figures. He is still using what Italian artists called chiaroscuro, which is the manipulation of light and dark to create the illusion of three-dimensionality, a perfectly good Renaissance technique, which if you take drawing classes at, you know, the Art Students League today, you still get taught how to do that, for example. And this illusion of three-dimensionality is still clearly present, even in both of these works. But it's on its way out. And one of the best ways, I think, to trace what Cézanne does in his painting is to look at a subject that he returned to really kind of over and over and over again in his work. And these were studies of a mountain, Mont Saint-Victoire, which is in Provence in south-central France. There's something about this mountain that seems to have really, in a sense, obsessed or at least gripped Cézanne's imagination and his sensibility. and he would return to it over and over and over again. Here is a study of Mont Saint-Victoire done in about 1885. Cézanne would paint this for about 20 years. You know, there are nearly 20 years worth of studies. Some are drawings, some are watercolors, some are full-scale oil paintings like you see here. It's amazing because it reminds one a little bit of, for example, the Impressionist painter Monet, Claude Monet, returning to his water lily garden at Giverny over and over and over again, just stepping outside his back door and painting that, you know, right up until the time he went blind in the 1920s. It also reminds one a little bit, on a completely different level, I think, of those beautiful, large, hovering rectangles of color that Mark Rothko discovered in the late 40s. And once he discovered that, that's what he painted until the end of his life, when he committed suicide. Actually, none of these artists who repeat these things really meet good ends, do they? There's a lesson embedded in here somewhere. This is another study of Mont Saint-Victoire, where you see, obviously, trees, an old aqueduct, the terrain and the territory of this particular region of France, south-central France. This one dates to about 1900. You can see that, again, these parallel brush strokes are what create the matter, the structure of the entire painting. And it all just seems to kind of hover rather mysteriously on the surface. And what's curious about these paintings in general, not just the Mont Saint-Victoire, but the later Cézanne works, is that there are some people who have looked at them and tried to find these very explicit traces of geometry. For example, there is a man named Duane Boyce, who actually is a painter by training. He studied at the Los Angeles Art Center and various other places in the 1950s. This is a name who was sort of new to me. I don't really know what his work looks like, although he does have a website. And beginning in about 1993, he got very interested, he says almost obsessed with, this idea of hidden or embedded geometry in a lot of Cézanne's later paintings. And he talks about, you know, this particular theory on conic solids in Cézanne's work as being an enormous labor of love. And he's been working on this now for close to 15 years. The work is, as far as I know, completely unpublished, and it's available only on the website that Boyce maintains. You get there, you know, by the way, everybody gets there, you type in Cézanne and geometry in a Google search, and one of the first hits you get is Duane Boyce's website, where he kind of works through his ideas. He's not a practicing art historian. There are some sort of bizarrely formatted footnotes and things in what he writes. And this is one of the diagrams that he produces on his website. In general, you can't reproduce the images. You can't get them off the website, you know, to insert into a nice PowerPoint program, except for this one. So I have borrowed this one. It's nonprofit use, so I'm sure it's okay. To give you some idea of what Duane Boyce thinks he sees in a lot of Cézanne's work. This, of course, is another painting of Mont Saint-Victoire. And it's a diagram with what Boyce calls the revealed cones, the conic sections. And if you follow the actual outlines, I think some of these do make a certain amount of sense. It is possible to imagine that there are these kind of conic sections in the painting. Some of them, to me, actually look quite arbitrary, that you could have put these diagrams almost anywhere and said, oh, there's another cone. Look, I found yet another cone in this painting. And the way that Boyce explains this, he talks about looking at Cézanne's work, and he uses the phrase covert geometry quite a bit. And he says that that covert geometry is the effective means by which Cézanne achieves space, which is as notable for its depth as his volumes for their weight and massiveness. So he's sort of making an argument that it is through this embedded and covert geometry, which not everyone can see, that's the real key to the structure of the space and the volume in Cézanne's paintings. He talks about, for example, the masses in the painting, which go back into space uncannily and somehow make secure a third dimension. He says that objects appear to form themselves before our eyes, to grow out of the surface of the pictures and then dissolve themselves into it again. And he also talks about, and we use his words for this, the consensus of the critics is that Cézanne's space, volume, and classical order was achieved by the intuitive manner with which Cézanne modulated the characteristics of color. Cool versus warm, simultaneous and successive contrast, advancing versus receding, etc. They, meaning the critics, are positive he had no formula or system. And this is where Duane Boyce thinks that art historians have erred or diverged with Cézanne's work, because he does see a system in here. He says that colors can, in fact, generate harmony, not concrete forms with weight and massiveness, but they do generate a kind of a visual harmony. So this is where the basis of his theory really lies. If you go to his website, this is all sort of laid out for you. Because he is not a practicing art historian, I think his argument sort of goes so far, and even he admits that he cannot quite, you know, make the final literal connection. You know, he talks about finding ways of Cézanne making these embedded figures and shapes effective, discernible by unconscious processes, but hidden from conscious vision. That's the real key, I think, to his theory. And he says the late Impressionist style is the perfect method for camouflaging the ellipses, cones, and cylinders. Sketchy images, loose outlines, color and tone changes, arbitrary masks, squiggly lines, washed out lines, bare canvas patches, etc. Boyce also further suggests that these subliminal shapes work in a way that he describes as visually eclectic. And that's about as far as he is able to take his particular theory. He talks a lot about what he calls a closed neuronal system and model, but we don't really know what that is. The word neuron is in there somewhere, of course. And he's actually, I think, really talking more about the connections and stimuli between geometry and perception more than anything else. And that, I mean, that's not a specialty of mine. It seems to be somewhat uncharted territory, although there are people who have done work on psychological connections with perception and geometry and what have you. In the end, of course, I think that Boyce makes a kind of compelling case for further study. When you look at these later Cézanne works, like The Trees and Rocks, of course, which we were talking about before, or, for example, like this study of Mont Saint-Victoire, yet another one, which is dated to about 1900, we can understand implicitly that if you break down the surface of this painting into these rectangular brushstrokes, I mean, the brushstrokes by themselves are inherently geometrical. You know, and the idea is that Cézanne is really seeing in everything that he looks at, whether it's a rock or a tree or a figure, you know, or the sky itself, he is sensing a kind of inherent, perhaps embedded, perhaps not so embedded as far as he's concerned, geometric structure. It's interesting, too, because some people have said, well, Cézanne is kind of thinking about the atomic nature of matter long before we get to the 20th century. You know, long before we get to people understanding what the very atomic basis of matter really is. And Cézanne, if you read back through his letters, although he was a relatively, you know, intelligent man, he was not keeping up with developments in science and color perception and theory and things like that. He was actually characterized by most of his contemporaries as actually a rather gruff, rather unpleasant man, many times, in fact. Although he had many friendships with artists and critics of the day, they all ended badly. He broke with almost everyone, including, of course, the Impressionist painter Camille Pissarro. And those of you who are regular MoMA goers, you know that was the subject of an exhibition here on the sixth floor, I guess about 2 years ago, the Pissarro, or Cézanne Pissarro show. Now, we go back to this word kaleidoscopic with a painting like this. You know, the way that these three-dimensional shapes are kind of broken down into these colored facets. And this is a kaleidoscope, just in case you haven't seen them for a while or haven't played with them. They're sort of great fun and great toys, and most of us know them from childhood. And this is kind of a typical kaleidoscopic view. In this case, you're looking inside a kaleidoscope with just little bits of colored material, which are basically repeated, you know, by means of mirrors over and over again. And you're putting together what looks like a very lovely kind of psychedelic composition, which we would date, if we didn't know otherwise, from, let's say, 1971. And I think that, you know, the kaleidoscopic terminology is a little overused with Cézanne, and not necessarily correct either, because kaleidoscopic views are almost inevitably symmetrical. They actually have more to do with mathematical symmetry than they have to do with what Cézanne was really dealing with. If you want to apply the phrase kaleidoscopic, then what you should be looking at, for example, is Islamic geometric art, because that's sort of a perfect example of a decorative tendency which uses a kind of kaleidoscopic effect. Now, this is a painting by Cézanne done in 1898. This is of the Bibémus Quarry, which is not far from Mont-Saint-Victoire in Provence. It's a subject, you know, part of the terrain, part of the local landscape, to which Cézanne would also return fairly regularly in his work. And I wanted to sort of show you this painting and ask, you know, really the last question that we want to ask today, which is, where does all of this stuff lead to? I mean, in a way, of course, we already set the stage for that in the introduction of the talk. But the way that the consensus view works, and certainly the way that the layout of the galleries upstairs on the fifth floor work, is that from Cézanne, you manage to get directly to Picasso. You get certainly to Picasso's Demoiselles d'Avignon from 1907. And eventually, you get to Picasso's Cubist phase, which really begins in about 1908. What you're looking at here is a work by Picasso called Girl with a Mandolin, which dates from 1909. And you know upstairs on the fifth floor, after you've made your way through the Cézannes, you might pause to take, you know, another look at Starry Night or something, and then you veer right into the galleries, which shows you a big room full of early Picassos and the development of Cubism, which is a style, nowadays we tend to think it's actually co-invented by Picasso and Georges Braque, a French painter living in Paris at the time, sharing a studio with Picasso. In fact, the latest versions of Cubism suggest it's really Braque who laid down the foundations, did a lot of the theorizing. Picasso just hogged the credit for it, basically. And if you've looked at Cubist paintings before, you know that what the Cubist artist is trying to do is to look at objects that are out there, again, in this visible world, out in front of the eyes, and somehow figure out a way to simultaneously show you the back and the front and the top and the bottom and the left side and the right side, you know, and the whole exterior surface and the interior surface, but all at the same time. You know, a way of kind of negating the way that the human eye actually perceives three-dimensional objects. And occasionally on gallery talks or, you know, special events in the evening for, I don't know, corporate executives and things like that, you have people look at Cubism and they say, but this isn't what a girl with a mandolin actually looks like. And of course the retort to that is, well, that's exactly the point. You know, Cubism is really an attempt to invent a completely new way of seeing three-dimensional objects. You could extend that or extrapolate that backwards and say Cézanne and his style and his paintings from his later works from the 1880s onward, in fact, is an attempt to completely reinvent how we see the structure of objects. You know, even just through the medium of landscape and still lives and figural studies, that's essentially what Cézanne is doing. And I've suggested to you as well early on in the lecture that not only is Cézanne a kind of a starting point for the developments in Cubism, which most art historians agree is one of the most important developments, certainly in the first half of 20th century painting, I think that you could actually make an argument that Cézanne's fragmentation of physical spaces and objects leads in a fairly direct manner to abstraction, which is yet another of the very important developments. I would almost argue that's the most important development of 20th century art, is abstract subject matter, subjects that are not rooted in the visible universe out in front of you, that come from somewhere else. You can see that, you know, if you choose several works almost at random. This is a piece by the Swiss-born artist Paul Klee. This dates from 1929, and it's called Highways and Byways. And we can look at, in fact, one of everyone's favorite abstract works here at the museum, upstairs on the fifth floor, which is Pete Mondrian's Broadway Boogie Woogie, the penultimate finished painting by the Dutch-born Mondrian, dated between 1942 and 1943, usually interpreted as Mondrian's reactions to the grid patterns of Manhattan streets, because he'd recently arrived in New York in 1942, the energy, the crowds on the streets, you know, the music, the boogie-woogie jazz, this very orderly mathematical dance music, which was all the rage in the 1940s, etc. Was Mondrian thinking all the way back to Cézanne when he painted this? Most likely not, at least not in any direct terminology, because we understand the process of Mondrian's development of abstraction. In fact, one of the nicest rooms on the fifth floor right now in the current installation, there's a whole room which is devoted to Mondrian, which shows you from his earliest perfectly recognizable representational landscapes how he works through his own variety of cubism and arrives at what most people call the grid style of his later works. So all of these things are basically in place because of what Cézanne does, because of what Cézanne sees. You know, even when there's no direct link, more and more when you look at the kind of works, especially that are on view in the first couple of rooms on the fifth floor, you begin to understand implicitly why the curators, I mean, ever since MoMA has been in existence, you know, since 1929, ever since the permanent collection really kind of took shape, Cézanne has always been at the start. There are alternate explanations for when modern art and really begins. Some people will say, well, what about Impressionism? Isn't that a completely, you know, divergent case from what's happening before? And there was a woman who attended Monday's lecture who said she'd just seen the Turner show in Washington. And she said now she thinks the Turner is really the kind of figure at the forefront of modern art. And, you know, you can build cases for any of those. MoMA's case, since they don't really have any Turners, is that it begins with Cézanne for the most part. You have to sometimes work very practically and just work with what you have. So perhaps next time you go up to the fifth floor and you visit the permanent collection, whether it's today, this afternoon, after the lecture, next week, later in the year, what have you, you will maybe look at these Cézannes and you will appreciate them in kind of a new way. They're part of this very common language of modernism. You know, Cézanne is not revolutionary when we look at it because we now have over a century of hindsight, you know, to say, oh, right, well, Cézanne, that's just like classical modernism. It's not such a big deal to see a Cézanne. The hard thing is to go back and try to imagine what it must have been like to see works like that in the late 1880s or 1890s, you know, how radically they diverge from almost everything that came before. And that's how you make the case for Cézanne's importance, if indeed it still has to be made at this point. So let me thank you very much for your time and attention today. We have time, actually, for a couple of questions. I don't have to race out of here just yet if anybody has any questions or comments. Yes, in the front row.
What was the scale of the clay that you showed?
Most of Clay's works are actually quite small. That one, if I remember correctly, that's probably about 12 inches wide by about, you know, 2 feet, maybe 26 inches high. Yes?
The first painting that you showed reminds me a great deal of Lovis Corinth, who was working at the same time,
mm-hmm.
and almost in a similar fashion.
You're talking about the self-portrait?
Yes.
Yeah, this was a comparison between, or a comment that there's a similarity between Cézanne's self-portrait and the German-born artist Lovis Corinth, who some of you may know. I don't think MoMA has a few pieces by him, but they're not usually on display. You have one?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
And it's almost a replica, an older replica of this.
Yeah, it's a very sort of thick, impasto-like application of paint, especially in those early works from Cézanne. You'll see that up through the 70s. And that's after that, that's when Cézanne's paint really thins out, and there are very often even blank areas of the canvas left. And you really start seeing that the kind of geometric grid on the paintings. Yes?
Isn't this more based on the classical grid that you were first talking about, the Roman, Italian classical? I mean, I don't really see the connection between Cézanne.
Well, with Mondrian, you know, any artist who winds up working abstractly basically discovers their own road to abstraction, you know, their own path. Mondrian got there by way of cubism. You know, he got there because he was looking out of the window of his Paris studio sort of around the time of World War I, from 1914 onward, and he was actually looking at the facade of the Gothic cathedrals in Paris and sort of rethinking them and reinterpreting them just as a series of linear motifs. And it's amazing because you actually see this in his canvases up on the fifth floor. Mondrian's got his own, I mean, he issued manifestos about this, basically incomprehensible manifestos about the purity of geometry and, you know, what was called neoplasticism, etc. But it's a way of breaking down objects. I mean, the starting point for Mondrian's abstraction, if you trace it back through cubism, is still that kind of physical world that's out there. And it's the process that Mondrian uses, more so than the final product, which I think owes at least some theoretical debt to Cézanne's work a couple of decades earlier. There was a hand. Yes?
Yes.
Where can we read this interview with Cézanne and Bernard?
The interview between Cézanne and Emile Bernard that I quoted from before. The source I used is a kind of common source book called Theories of Modern Art, and it's edited by a man named Herschel Chipp, C-H-I-P-P. It's kind of a standard collection of primary sources. And he will tell you in that book, I forget offhand where he excerpted that from, but that would give you the information. Yes?
Now, when you were saying that Cézanne was moving away from the three-dimensionality and the front field, the middle, and back, what occurred to me, in a way, wasn't that like, again, to coming full circle to before the effort to even do perspective?
Well, I mean, if you wanted to, you could find, you know, what's interesting is if you look at, say, early medieval art. Yeah, and you look at, for example, this is a question about, by the way, Cézanne moving away from middle ground, foreground, background, moving away from three-dimensionality. You know, in some ways, it is, in a very generalized way, a kind of replication of what happens in the medieval European world, the further that medieval European artists got from the classical ideal of the Greeks and Romans. So I would say that's a kind of a valid historical parallel for very different reasons. Yes?
Do some of his paintings have more than one perspective? That is, he couldn't possibly have painted them from one spot. It seems to me I saw them in the Washington show that looked like that, and I wondered if I would have.
From what I understand of Cézanne's working technique, you know, he very often worked en plein air, or outside. This is a question, if you didn't hear it, by the way, about do some of Cézanne's paintings have more than one perspective? In other words, made from more than one location. As far as we know, he didn't actually do that. You know, he really was standing usually in one spot. There's a certain amount of artistic license involved, like Van Gogh, importing things into paintings that are not actually there in the view of Starry Night, for example. But for the most part, Cézanne planted himself and interpreted what he saw, you know, really kind of refracted it through the lens of his particular sensibility and the way that had developed. Yes?
Early 20th century Russian abstract geometrical art, does that follow the same path or is that independent?
Well, if you look at early Russian art, you actually have sort of two paths to Russian abstraction. One is the path that's claimed by or taken by Vasily Kandinsky, who's generally acknowledged to be the first purely abstract painter in the 20th century. He comes at abstraction partly through understanding that organic forms can be perceived abstractly. And, you know, MoMA illustrates that in the gallery where they have their Kandinskys. You can see that pretty clearly. He also, of course, talks a lot about the subconscious and the upconscious and these motifs that are hovering around inside his head, basically. A lot of the other, like Russian constructivism, so we're talking sort of about Kazimir Malevich, who actually is Ukrainian by birth, and somebody like Alexander Rodchenko, they arrive at their abstraction, I think, much more through the language of mathematics.
Independent of Cézanne?
I would say independent of Cézanne, Russian artists and Ukrainian artists would have known less about Cézanne's work than artists living and working, let's say, in France and Germany at the time, particularly France, I think. Yes?
Can you expand more on the term fragmentation as it refers to Cézanne?
Expanding more on the term fragmentation as it appears to Cézanne. I think basically what art historians mean is the idea of looking at, you know, the way that the eye perceives the world at large out in front of your eyes, essentially as a collection of three-dimensional solids with perspective, with volume, you know, more than just mass and shape. And the idea of fragmentation really means flattening out. It's like if Cézanne were painting this water bottle, he would take the water bottle and you would see it not as a kind of rounded three-dimensional object, but if you could somehow just flatten this out and understand it as a series of fragments of color, mostly green, that would be put together to construct this approximation of the water bottle. That's what fragmentation would be. Maybe one last question if anybody has one. In the back, yes.
One of your comments talked about rectangles instead of triangles. Are we talking about all geometric shapes, cones, rectangles, triangles?
Well, I mean, if you look at Cézanne's brushstrokes, you're basically talking about rectangular brushstrokes. What this man, Dwayne Boyce, and a few others have talked about are cones and spheres in particular. And Boyce has made a specialty, his own specialty, of finding conic solids in Cézanne's work. Cézanne himself talks about cones and spheres in that one letter, that 1904 letter to Emile Bernard. But that doesn't mean he's actually, you know, going to paint a sphere and then somehow transform that into an object. If anything, it probably works the reverse way, I think, in Cézanne's work. Okay. Pardon me?
When were flats introduced in terms of the mechanics of the brush stroke? Would have been late 19th century?
Flat brushes? When were flat brushes introduced?
I mean, you could make a different stroke.
Right. You know, I don't know the answer to that question. I would imagine that they were available before that, though. You would have to sort of look into the history of materials that painters used. It's a good question, though. Does the material actually allow, you know... I mean, in some ways, when you look at the history of painting, the history of materials is kind of embedded in it somewhere. But there are certain tools and things, you know, that that are used that really do change, you know, I mean, sort of like the airbrush versus the paintbrush when that comes along. I don't think this would be something quite that radical, but that's an interesting question worth a little bit of further study, I think. Okay, thank you very much.
Hi, I missed your name.